Thanks for coming along this morning. My name's Greg Lyon. I'm a former chairman of Greens List and Silk that practices in both criminal work and regulatory work. The speakers we have today are Simon Rubenstein and Adrian Muller, both from Greens List. Simon, you may know as practicing predominantly in ASIC work, regulatory work, which is no surprise. He has a background in ASIC work from having worked for the organisation back in the days of the Rivkin insider trading trial. Adrian Muller's more recently come to the bar, but only after a number of years practicing in major commercial work for Baker & McKenzie, and with a focus particularly on trade practices and work surrounding the ACCC. So our speakers today are certainly well-versed in the matters that bring us here today. Now, we should never forget that when one area of practice dies, another arises, and whilst there's been a real decline in our generation of legal practice in what we would call, or what the older members of the audience would perceive as traditional litigation, where private individuals or small businesses take other small businesses to court. Whilst that's died off, what we have seen is a tremendous growth in the power and the activity of the regulator. And when we say regulator, in this instance, we're talking about ASIC and the ACCC, but you can add the ACCC to the mix. You can also add the ATO. It takes only moments to think back and see how active ASIC has been in the last 12 months. The most recent and perhaps biggest of the headlines for ASIC in recent times has been the plea of guilty of two of the directors of Opus Prime, which came after a three-year investigation. There has been a plea of guilty within 12 months of the collapse of Sonray, a financial organisation. We saw in yesterday's business papers the ASIC investigation of Hanlong Securities in its looking at the activities of three of the directors for insider trading. It was within 6 months of the investigation of the Computershare fraud that one of its directors pleaded guilty. So you can see from that that there's two lessons. The first is that ASIC is becoming more active in the use of its powers. And secondly, it's completing its investigations and securing pleas, securing the evidence in very quick time frames. Computershare within 6 months, Sonray within 12 months, and Opus Prime a little longer, that's been 3 years. But Hanlong, the trading that has led to the freezing of assets, only took place on in the week commencing the 4th of July. It's important also to realise the extent of powers that are being used by regulators. We see that not only are they bringing investigations and criminal prosecutions, but they have power also to bring civil penalty proceedings. And perhaps the area that touches most of us most often is representing clients at compulsory hearings. A strange beast indeed, where there are very few rights extended to the examinees during the course of the examination, but which can yield great results for the regulator. In terms of the ACCC, we've seen equally high profile matters arise over the last little while. There was the cab charge matter that was just recently successfully litigated. Baxter Healthcare, And of course, there's a constant monitoring of cartel activity, as we've seen, although proceedings against Mr. Pratt were discontinued before he died. There was an ongoing inquiry into the paper and box activities. And of course, the two great sources of constant monitoring for the ACCC are the airline cargo matters, and you've only just got to say the word Optus or Telstra and the lawyers start rubbing their hands. The telecommunications has been a favourite of the ACCC. So it's important to understand what this means for you in practice and more importantly, what it means for your clients. With the changing face of the legal landscape, with this increased activity by the regulators, you need to know what to do because they have what to the older in the audience would consider draconian powers, none of which existed when we all went through law school. They have these sweeping powers to do things and they do them very, very fast. So let's find out what it is that you should do. Can I introduce the first speaker, Simon Rubenstein?
Good morning. Two apologies to start with. The first is that I've had a bit of a cold and so I apologise if my voice comes across as a bit croaky and there's some untoward sneezing in the midst of the middle of the talk. That's the first apology. The second apology is, look, if you're here to hear me prattle on about cases, authorities, what the latest opining is of some English law lord or something like that, you're going to be sorely disappointed. It's going to be very practical this morning, really. This and the discussion that I want to have or generate this morning is really going to be some practical tips, some practical pointers, which usually starts when, and we've had that situation, when the client arrives at your offices, hands over the notice and says, I've just been hit with this notice by ASIC and they want me to do X, Y and Z. Can you tell me what is this all about? I really don't understand and I want to know what my rights are. So that's really a good starting point about what I'm going to talk to you about this morning. I've provided a paper in the bundle. It's really sort of a speaking notes that deals with effectively the six topics that I want to come across, or that I want to deal with. The first is what the importance of determining your role or the role of your client in the ASIC investigation or the ASIC inquiries, and that's really the starting point. The second is advising about notices to produce documents. The third is preparation for and attendance at Section 19 examinations. The fourth is advising clients about timing of investigations and inquiries, and then publicity that stems from that. Often there are questions about, will this be public? Will my name be in the media? So on and so forth. Then we'll deal briefly with enforceable undertakings because that's usually an area that gets quite a bit of interest. And then I'll deal at the end with the opposite position, which is when you have a client who says, look, I want to go to ASIC, I want to make a complaint, and just touch briefly upon that situation as well. So it's going to be practically dealing with those areas. Just beforehand, and I digress a little bit, in the beginning of the paper, in the introduction, I set out effectively the aims and objectives of ASIC and set out what the basic enforcement powers are, where those powers arise from. Very simply, as we all know, ASIC is the corporate and financial services regulator. It derives its power from the Australian Securities and Investments Commission Act and also from the Corporations Act. The ASIC Act, as I'll refer to it, effectively sets out the functions and objectives of ASIC. They include broad sweeping statements like maintaining and facilitating the performance of the financial system and the entities within that system in the interests of commercial certainty, reducing business costs and efficiency and development of the economy. But also included in the objectives of ASIC are interesting objectives such as to ensure that information is available as soon as practicable for access by the public. Now, that doesn't just mean the information that we're talking about, statutory information about corporations that you get when you do an ASIC search. It also means, and ASIC have effectively extended that to publicity about its investigations, putting out press releases, media releases, so on and so forth, and that's one of the topics that I'm going to touch upon. Obviously, that's something that's been borrowed from the ACCC, which it has done successfully over its life and incantation as the Trade Practices the Trade Practices Commission and the ACCC as well. So ASIC's borrowed heavily from the model that was originally set up by the ACCC. Now, ASIC has very broad investigative powers, and they are set out in Part 3 of the ASIC Act. And effectively, ASIC can make any investigations that it thinks expedient for the due administration of corporations legislation, where it has reason to suspect that there may have been committed the following. Firstly, a contravention of that legislation, or secondly, a contravention of a law of a Commonwealth or of a state or territory that concerns the management of the affairs of a body corporate or a managed investment scheme, or involves fraud or dishonesty and relates to a body corporate, a managed investment scheme, or to financial products. That's effectively the broad mandate that we're talking about. The significance of a formal investigation conducted by ASIC means that its statutory powers of investigation kick in, and they are quite extraordinary powers, as we will see. They really are a full, broad suite of coercive powers, with some protections into the mix, but not a lot. Now, I've identified the six areas I want to cover. The first is really that first initial point where the client arrives at your office and says, look, I need to understand how this affects me. And it's very difficult to make that assessment at first instance. Usually the first chance that you'll get to advise on that is because you'll get the notice that has been provided by ASIC or the covering letter that has come from ASIC. And you'll examine or inspect that notice or letter, and it will tell you a few things. Firstly, it'll tell you what the nature and scope of the ASIC investigation is, and secondly, it should give you some direction or clue as to the role or involvement that your client might have. Now, how do you identify the nature and scope of the investigation? It's not always straightforward, and it often morphs as the investigation moves on. But firstly, the statutory notice will tell you three things. Firstly, it must set out the relevant period of events that ASIC is investigating, so you'll get a time frame. Secondly, it'll tell you what the relevant sections of the Corporations Act or the ASIC Act are that are being considered by ASIC. And finally, it'll tell you the name of the company or the name of the persons involved in ASIC's investigation at that initial stage. And that effectively gives you three things to triangulate: time period, the sections, which will give you an idea about whether we're talking about a breach of director's duties, are we talking about insider trading, are we talking about continuous disclosure, are we talking about insolvent trading? And it'll also give you the name of the companies and the relevant persons. So it gives you a basis to then take instructions from clients about those things. ASIC's, of course, not limited to the things that are identified or set out in the statutory notice. It's got effectively a broad power, and there's authority to provide that ASIC investigation can morph and change and move as information is effectively gained by the investigators. For example, ASIC might serve a notice that identifies section 183, breach of director's duties in relation to obtaining an improper advantage by the director of company information or company information, company property. And the ASIC investigators might conduct an examination and discover in the course of that investigation, in the course of an examination, for example, there's information to suggest that that director has used that information to purchase shares on the ASX whilst the information is effectively non-public and is materially price sensitive. So it will then transfer or morph into an insider trading investigation. And there are authorities to provide that that's appropriate for ASIC to change the scope of its investigation in that way and use its statutory powers to effectively broaden out to an insider trading investigation. The statutory notice will also identify the name of the investigator who's issued the notice, and that's an important thing. You might, and I'll explain why shortly, be in a situation where you need to get on the telephone or contact that investigator by email, to ask a series of questions. Now, once you've identified the scope and nature of the investigation, the next step is to identify the role that your client is going to play in those matters, or the likely role that they're going to play. And there are three broad types of roles they might play. Firstly, they themselves might be the key suspect or a main suspect in the investigation. That is what ASIC refer to as the person of interest, or the principal person of interest. Secondly, they might be a person whom, if the investigation commences and information is obtained by ASIC, they might become the person of interest. That is, ASIC may not know exactly what it's looking for, but upon moving along that investigative process, it might discover that the person that you're acting for effectively has is involved in the matters under investigation, so that they'll become a principal suspect. A potential contravention might be disclosed. The final category of person broadly is the person who ASIC have issued a notice to, because they can, or ASIC believes they can, assist ASIC in their investigation generally. They've got information that will enable ASIC to proceed with its investigation or proceed with a conviction or something along that line. Now, they're usually the most, people that are going to come into the investigation for a short point in time and then might drop out. They're easier to act for in a certain respect, and usually you can satisfy them that their role is going to be quite limited. But they're not as fun to act for, of course, because we all, as lawyers, like to act for the key suspects, the principal persons. It's going to be more interesting, and potentially it's going to be more remunerative. So the relevance of who the person is in the investigation is important for a number of reasons. Firstly, if it's the principal person of interest, it is more likely that as a legal advisor, you are going to be indicating to them that ASIC should be using their full coercive powers to force you to effectively come into step in the investigation. That is, you won't be doing things voluntarily in the investigation. And the reason why you may not be doing things voluntarily in the investigation is you want to rely upon some of the privileges and some of the statutory rights that you've got, that effectively the right against self-incrimination and so on and so forth, that you get if ASIC use their coercive powers. If you are a person who is just assisting ASIC with its investigation, you might be more likely to negotiate an outcome with ASIC. You might be more likely to cooperate with ASIC. For example, you might give a voluntary statement to ASIC rather than going through a Section 19 examination process, a compulsory examination process. You might sit down with ASIC in an informal manner and give a statement. Now, the reason you might do that is because you have more control over that process. And as a lawyer, you have more control over that process. ASIC will be providing you with drafts of the statement. You can amend that draft. You have control over that drafting process. You have control over what your client says. You don't have that same control when it's a statutory examination and that your client is forced to answer the questions under oath. So there are benefits of the voluntary process, but it very much depends upon determining who your client is and what's the likely outcome of the ASIC investigation for your client. There are reasons why, even if you are voluntarily assisting ASIC, or that is you're a person who might assist ASIC, you still might require ASIC to use its compulsory powers. And that's in circumstances where there are issues of confidentiality. For example, a bank, an accountant, an advisor of some kind, a lawyer, so on and so forth, that might be subject to duties of confidentiality, or just in a commercial arrangement or commercial agreements between parties that require confidentiality. So as a lawyer, you would say to your client, well, I think that ASIC should use its coercive powers because you've got obligations yourself of confidentiality to other people. Allow the coercive powers then to be used so that under law, those confidences can effectively be breached, or at least there is an excuse for you to have handed those documents over because you've been compelled to do so rather than voluntarily cooperated. All right, that's effectively, in a nutshell, the first step of identifying your client and their likely role. The next step is to deal with the issue of production of documents. There are two broad types of notices that ASIC uses, a Section 30 and a Section 33 notice. I deal with this at the top of page 5. Section 30 notices are generally issued to the body corporate or the officers of the body corporate itself. Eligible person is the definition that's used in relation to a body corporate. And they, Section 30 notice calls for books that relate to the affairs of the body corporate. And then a Section 33 notice is usually to the world at large, other individuals that might have in their possession books that relate to that body corporate. Definition of possession is very broad. It includes, as we understand, issues of documents that are in your custody or legal control as well. So it might require inquiries to be made of third parties, lawyers, accountants, so on and so forth. There are a few recurring issues that arise when dealing with ASIC notices. Now, I should say this, I'm talking about ASIC notices here. I'm not talking about search warrants under the Commonwealth Crimes Act. There's a whole other area that arises when the federal police are involved. ASIC itself doesn't issue search warrants. They're the purveyor of the federal police, but ASIC does so in conjunction with the federal police as well. So the Section 30, 33 notice process is usually provides you and your client with more time to deal with the notice. Obviously, if it's a search warrant, the police are going to be knocking at the door, usually very early in the morning or late at night, and they're going to be forcibly entering onto the premises to search for documents. It's a different issue. 33 notices don't provide the same powers for ASIC. ASIC have in the past tried to issue what they call forthwith notices. That is, here's the notice, produce the documents forthwith. My experience with those is that they should be resisted, or they usually are resisted, because the provisions for compliance with these ASIC processes have an element of reasonableness in them, and it's very rarely is it reasonable for ASIC to knock at the door with a forthwith notice and say, hand over the documents straight away. And that's because it may well be that these documents require consideration. Inquiries might need to be made about relevance of the documents. Legal advice might need to be sought about whether or not there are issues of legal professional privilege, and so on and so forth. So it's very, in my experience, unfair and unreasonable to ASIC to rely upon a forthwith notice. But they still do it on occasion. So the first of the recurring issues is the adequacy of the description of documents in a notice. You should appreciate that an investigator sitting there drafting one of these notices, and they're drafted internally by investigators or lawyers, effectively is going to use the scattergun approach, broad categories as broad as possible. And because that general approach is taken to the drafting of these notices, it means that the ambit can be exceptionally wide, and it can mean that boxes, filing cabinets, rooms full of documents need to be searched and sometimes need to be produced. So therefore, you should negotiate that process. If they are broad categories, firstly, you should contact the investigator who's issued the notice, have a discussion with them. Can the categories be narrowed? If the categories can't, what are you really looking for? Can I assist you in what you really are looking for? Can we effectively, can we confine the broad scope? Can we make it a bit narrower? Because this is really the type of documents that you're seeking, not those types of documents. If it is a broad category of documents, can the documents be produced in tranches rather than being produced in the time frame that's provided in the notice? All of these things can be negotiated with ASIC, and they're usually pretty reasonable about it, particularly if you explain the difficulties that you have with the description and the time frames that are provided for in the notice. A lot of this is common sense. A lot of you will have these types of, or conduct your, deal with these matters in the ordinary course of discovery and so on and so forth. You'll bring a pragmatic common sense approach, and the same should be taken with ASIC as well. So time frames, I've explained the issue about tranches. You might have to also make inquiries with third parties, banks, lawyers, accountants to see whether or not documents fall into legal possession as well. Don't forget electronic documents. There is often electronic documents at issue. I mean, in this day and age, documents are almost invariably maintained on computers. There'll be soft copy documents, and the computers might need to be searched as well. And you should also consider issues for your client about provision of copies of documents rather than originals of documents, particularly if the documents are necessary for the continued business use. So you might be saying to ASIC, look, can we hand over copies of these documents? If ASIC require the original documents, make sure that copies of documents are taken. It might be worthwhile taking copies of documents in any event, because the number of times that you'll get into a dispute with ASIC later that wasn't the version of the document that was provided, this was the version of the document provided, and you've got that version from another source, that happens, that arises. So keep a copy of the documents that go over to ASIC, because it's much more difficult to get those documents back or to get copies of those documents once they're in ASIC's possession. A third issue is claims for legal professional privilege. There was a time that ASIC did not recognise rights to claim LPP over documents that were sought to be obtained under a notice. That was because there was an old series of cases, Corporate Affairs and Yule, ASIC and Dell Eagles, that effectively said that the right for legal professional privilege was abrogated by virtue of the ASIC Act, Section 68 in the ASIC Act. The case of Daniels and ACCC, which was a case that dealt with the ACCC's notice powers, but the sections in the then Trade Practices Act were the same as the sections in the ASIC Act, the court said, no, legal professional privilege is not abrogated. Now, it took ASIC a long time to put that authority into its own practices with notices. But it does now, and it does recognise, and you'll see this in a covering letter that comes with a notice, you'll see it recognised. The way they do it is they say, if you've got a claim for LPP, we regard it as a reasonable excuse for you not to hand over the documents. So it comes back to this issue about what are reasonable excuses for you not to comply with a requirement of ASIC. It's an enshrined right at common law for your clients to claim legal professional privilege, but it's a statutory reasonable excuse. They push the boundaries every now and then. But what they do is they require a regime for claims for legal professional privilege. They will require you to produce a list of the documents or the portion of the document over which a claim for privilege is claimed, and a brief description as to the nature of that document, so that there can be, if there is an argument about whether or not it's a proper claim for privilege, then that can be taken to a court at a later time. And the covering letters that come with notices set that regime out. I want to deal then very quickly with then preparing and attending Section 19 examinations. Section 19 is the section of the ASIC Act which sets up the compulsory examination process. The compulsory examination process is effectively a star chamber examination. They're held in private. Examinees are subject to directions about confidentiality of the matters that are discussed in the Section 19 examination. The fact of holding a Section 19 examination itself is not private. So you can tell your clients that they can tell others that as they've been examined by ASIC. It's the contents of the examination that are in private and confidential. Examinees are permitted to have lawyers present, but the role for lawyers in that process is reasonably constrained to dealing with questions of relevance, dealing with clarification of questions, and so on and so forth. There's very little basis to and very little opportunity to object to the questioning per se. Early preparation for Section 19s is very helpful if you can. Often a client will come to you with a Section 19 notice saying the examination is tomorrow, and it's very difficult then to properly prepare for it. If you've got a bit more time than that, ask the client to produce the documents that might be relevant, go through the documents with the client, go through a bit of a training, a cross-examination exercise with your client, get them ready for that process, get them used to effectively the pressure of asking questions under oath. And I usually take the approach that don't amplify your answers to questions, keep it yes, no, I can't remember, so on and so forth. Don't sit there and effectively answer the question in the way that you think the examinee wants it answered. But as we all know, and we've seen witnesses do this in witness boxes, they tend to run away and all of a sudden they're gone and they're off agreeing to all sorts of propositions and things and giving a whole account of what happened from the very moment that they were born to the very moment that ASIC have sent them a notice for their examination. It happens all the time and it's very frustrating when that happens. Usually it's a good time for a toilet break when that happens, and you'll ask the examiner, oh, excuse me, can we stop for a brief moment to remind your client not to run away, not to just be so loquacious with the answers. So that deals with preparation. At page 8, I deal with some of the particular issues in Section 19 examinations. Look, one of the things about Section 19 examinations is because of this issue of confidentiality and privacy, often the best opportunity that you've got to yourself take instructions, give advice to your client is before the Section 19 examination takes place. And you might make inquiries about who else within the company, who else within the group of associates have received notices from ASIC. You might then sit down and discuss approaches and what answers, without schooling witnesses, what might occur, because you can do that before the examinations take place. You can't do that after the examinations take place. Now, that's what might happen in a perfect world, but it doesn't always happen like that for reasons that I've explained. You might be dragged into this very late in the piece. Your client might turn up with a notice and say, I've got to go tomorrow or I've got to go the next day to this examination. You don't get an opportunity or chance to do all of that. The procedures at a Section 19 examination, they're pretty straightforward. They're taped. They're always taped and recorded. They don't always produce a transcript of that, but these days it's pretty common that they are producing transcripts. It's rare that they don't. The examiners will go through usually 5 or 10 minutes of statutory gumph, setting out all the statutory rights, so on and so forth, and usually you've got to pinch your client to keep them awake at that point in time. They explain legal professional privilege, they explain privilege against self-incrimination. Of course, you should have done all of this beforehand so your client knows all of these things. They make statements such as claims for privilege, for privilege against self-incrimination. The word privilege has got to be claimed in respect of each answer. That's the position that ASIC take. You find some practitioners have got little cards made up now that have the word privilege printed on it, and they poke people with a pen in their ribs as they go along saying privilege, privilege, privilege. I usually interrupt the opening section from the ASIC examinees and say, look, you might ask 1,000 questions in this examination. My client might say privilege in respect of 995. He or she might forget to say privilege in respect of the answers to 5. You shouldn't assume that we're giving up a claim for privilege in those circumstances. You should assume that in that situation, they've just forgot to say privilege, but privilege will apply if it is appropriate to make a claim for privilege in respect of that answer. That usually doesn't give rise to any problems. One of the things that I'm finding very frustrating and curious in these Section 19 examinations now is ASIC's approach to privacy and confidentiality directions. Section 22 of the ASIC Act simply says examinations are to be conducted in private, full stop. ASIC have assumed that means that they can then make all sorts of confidentiality directions, forcing people into confidentiality periods. Now, there is some authority to suggest that they can do so. If it's not open-ended, it's got to be a short period of time. But where it gets very difficult is when they start to impose that confidentiality undertaking, or the confidentiality direction, put it that way, on the lawyers who attend. And I often find that what they do is they say, only you, lawyer, attending this examination can discuss these matters. You're subject to the confidentiality undertaking. You can't discuss it with anyone else. Now, that's somewhat artificial, particularly if the lawyer is a barrister or a senior associate or a partner of a firm that might then want to go off and discuss matters with another partner in the firm or a senior associate who's also involved in the file. I raise that usually and I say, look, as counsel, I've got obligations. I will walk out of here, I'll get on the phone to my instructor and I will talk to my instructor and brief my instructor about what occurred at the 19 examination. I will tell my instructor, these are the issues that I think the client's got to be concerned about. That's my job, that's my role, and you can't prohibit me and you can't direct me not to do so. That usually turns into a bit of a fight with ASIC. And usually the examination is adjourned for a period of time for them to run away. Usually they come back saying, that's okay. Sometimes they come back saying, we want a list of who at the law firm who has briefed you, you are likely to speak to. We want them to provide confidentiality undertakings each as well. And I say, does that mean you want the personal assistant of the people as well to give those undertakings because maybe they've got to type up a file note or a memo? Do you want the photocopy person at the firm as well to give that undertaking because they might photocopy some documents that arise out of the Section 19 examination? It becomes a bit of a game and it's a bit of a frustrating one. It's an area I think that there needs to be some sort of clarification in the law about. Anyway, unfortunately there's no easy answers. At the conclusion of the examination, the examinee is often, or examinee by their representative, is often given an opportunity to ask questions or clarify certain points in the examination. At page 9 of the paper, I talk a bit about that, and I talk about the merits of why you might do so and why you might not. I regularly don't take that opportunity. I take the view that it's ASIC's investigation. The Section 19 process is a fact-finding process. They can find their own facts. I don't need to help them find facts. If I've got defences that I want to make out, they will be raised in any subsequent proceedings, or they'll be raised outside of the examination process. Other people take different approaches and spend hours conducting an examination of their own clients. The only circumstances where I think you might do it, if it's that really crystal clear situation where your client just wasn't involved, you've got the evidence that your client wasn't involved, ASIC don't know that you can present the airline tickets to show that they were in, you know, Fiji, Italy, wherever it was at the time of the investigation, and that there's absolutely no way that the allegations that are being put to them by the ASIC examinees could arise. Clear defences. And even then, I'd still think twice about whether or not I would do that. Anyway, there's different approaches. People have different views about those things. Transcripts. ASIC will produce... Transcripts. ASIC will produce a transcript of the examination. They will usually ask the examiner to sign the transcript. They will often put an endorsement on the transcript to say that the examinee has read the transcript and believes that it's true and correct, or it's been transcribed correctly, or it contains a correct representation of the matters that were discussed. If the transcript is 100 pages long, or 200 pages long, it's often a pointless exercise in having the client read through it all and endorse it as being true and correct. Usually I ask or tell clients to cross off the endorsement and sign the transcript. The obligation is only to sign the transcript. It isn't to endorse that it's true and correct. Of course, the examination proceeds under oath, so examinees are obliged to answer the questions that are put to them truthfully, and there are consequences of not doing so. So I don't see the point of endorsing the transcript as ASIC do. It's one of these pushing the boundaries issues. I don't see the point in endorsing it as being a true and correct record. Transcripts can also, at page 9 I talk about the issue of transcripts being private. They are private. ASIC keep the transcripts confidential and private. There are three general exceptions to that. ASIC will use them in their own enforcement proceedings. So you'll often find that if the examination then leads to a proceeding in court, that transcript might find itself into an affidavit or attached to an affidavit by an ASIC investigator that is then used in court, and then it's read in court and it's public. Subpoenas, you can subpoena ASIC transcripts, and if you're involved in litigation, you might issue a subpoena to get hold of an ASIC transcript. So that's another way that it won't be private. There's also a process under Section 25 of the ASIC Act for third parties through their lawyers to seek transcripts of people that they know have been examined if they want to use those transcripts for the purposes of legal proceedings or contemplated legal proceedings brought in good faith. That's being used more and more, that provision. Usually you find it being used by plaintiff law firms who are bringing class actions, you know, Centro-type claims or AWB-type claims, and they will apply for the examination. Very briefly, I'll finish with, there's enforceable undertakings and the paper deals with those. I'll finish dealing with the issue of timing and publicity because I'm running out of time myself. I've run out of time myself. Timing and publicity. Page 10 of the paper. People will often say, how long is this investigation going to take? I haven't heard anything from ASIC. What do I do? I'm concerned. My usual view is don't be concerned. The longer it takes for ASIC to investigate, in my experience, the less likely it is that there's going to be an investigative outcome. Usually, with time, it comes changes in investigative teams, lack of interest, other matters, other enforcement priorities that come in on top, over the top. So the longer it takes for an outcome to be achieved, usually the better it is for your client. The quicker they are, usually they've formed a view and they've moved pretty quickly to an outcome, and usually that outcome is one where there's a prosecution or enforcement action that follows. Publicity. ASIC are their media. They crave media, and they will always put out a media release. They'll put out a media release. Usually, if they decide to lay charges or commence an enforcement action, they'll put out a media release at the beginning of that process. That will be usually a bland one, particularly if it's criminal proceedings. ASIC have issued criminal proceedings. These are the charges. They will always put out a media release at the end of those proceedings when there's sentencing or when there's an enforcement outcome, an order of the court, an injunction or something like that. Very rarely do they put out media releases if they've lost. It's usually only with the very, very large cases, and it's usually only when there's pressure and scrutiny on them. Now, that might be a good thing. That is, you might want to be publicity shy for your client. Your client wants to be publicity shy. But on the other hand, if there's been a bit of scrutiny and the client then is absolved through an order of the court or there's a conviction, there's a criminal proceeding where there has been the charges have been dismissed effectively, then you might say to ASIC, well, you should be putting out a media release saying we've brought action and we've been unsuccessful. The charges are not proven and the client has been, is effectively, the charges against the client's been dismissed. And ASIC do that in certain circumstances, and you might be looking to negotiate with ASIC on that. They don't often negotiate media releases, but they do in certain circumstances. You might have some luck if you discuss it with the investigative team that's dealing with the matter. I've run out of time. Enforceable undertakings are at page 11 and 12. I set out there the Regulatory Guide 100, which sets out what the processes are for the taking and negotiation of enforceable undertakings. Page 13 and onwards, I deal with clients making complaints. It's all set out. It's pretty clear. And if you've got any questions about that, I can deal with questions at the end, or you can always contact me at any time. And I apologise for running over time.